Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 20th, 2006. Today's session is entitled, Sherman Alexie's, What You Pawn, I Will Redeem. Our presenter today is Dave Crow, session number CRD 2006-2. Let's listen.
Anyone here from Seattle? Or Spokane? Yeah, so you know that Sherman Alexie is a Seattle writer. Some of you probably had it many book signings and that sort of thing. True? No? Yeah, okay. Anyone see Smoke Signals, the film? I have not.
Yeah,
it's
great.
Is it?
Yeah.
Good. I'm just learning about Alexie myself. I just encountered this story recently and thought it would be a fun one for Holden. I'm certainly no Sherman Alexie expert, but I knew I'd enjoy the experience of getting a group of people to try to figure the story out, so that's what we're going
to do. One of his stories he relates, he was in Yakima some years ago.
Ooh.
A couple rednecks came by in a pickup truck and hollered, "Why don't you go back where you came from?"
Yeah.
He says, "I am."
Yeah. Those are the next time. I'll get you a copy though, okay? Oh, actually, yeah, for those who don't have a copy, if you'd like to get a copy when you get back to that other civilization, the New Yorker site has this story posted. You can download it anytime you want. It was originally published in the New Yorker and then collected in this book, Ten Little Indians, which turns out to be quite a good book. I'm really enjoying it.
He also has done some films.
Yeah, he has written screenplays. Smoke Signals is his most famous one.
Mm-hmm.
He admits in an interview I read today that I don't have copies of this story anymore, I'm sorry. He admits that he just pandered to the popular taste of this screenplay. He said, hey, I had to get the public's attention with this first film because I wasn't going to get a second chance, and he thinks that maybe his subsequent films, he can take on some more important issues because he'll have that permission. So, kind of interesting. I think we can start now. As I mentioned yesterday to those who were here, I'm a literature teacher, and I don't know how to talk about literature without having a text in front of us. And so what I've decided to do here in my five sessions at Holden is to read something aloud so that we share that text together, short stories in this case, and then we will try to discuss what the story has to tell us about faith and spirituality, and we'll see if we can't figure out the some portion of the meaning of the text together. Today's story is, no, sorry, that's for next time. hands up! Today's story is Sherman Alexie's What You Pawn, I Will Redeem, and we are going to have to be alert to a number of things. I'll give you some hints before I go ahead and read aloud. I know that's a difficult way to take in a story. If you're anything like me, you have to read and reread and reread parts of the story and see how it's knitted together and figure those things out. You won't have that luxury today, but I will help you a little bit by saying that we first of all have to figure out who you is and who I is in the title. That is, who's doing the pawning and who's doing the redeeming of the pawn. You're going to notice that the story basically takes place over 24 hours, and during that 24 hours, the main character, a Spokane Coeur d'Alene Indian named Jackson Jackson, has to get the money together to redeem an artifact that you're going to learn about from a pawn shop. But that's just the text of the story. The subtext of the story, I think, is altogether lovelier. In fact, this is not a very lovely story. Is PG okay? That's actually R. R is an R story. I could summarize one short paragraph and it would be PG, but we're grown-ups. And we're not all grown-ups in yesterday's session. There were two people about that high. So I could not have read that portion. I think that this story is fundamentally about, at least in my reading of the story, it's fundamentally about forms of debt, earning, repayment, sharing, and giving. Watch for those things as you read along with me or listen, and I think that will help you to organize the story. Of course, that's only my reading of the story. You may have another that is more powerful and more interesting, and I hope so.
Is it a true story?
No, it's a fictional story. Right. So, are we ready? Here we go. It's going to take all of half an hour, I'm sure, maybe longer.
I just want to say real quick that in Eastern Washington and among the tribe, they say Coeur d'Alene.
Coeur d'Alene?
Yeah, we don't pronounce all that French stuff correctly.
You know, there are a number of Washington towns in this thing that, like Interior Salish.
Salish.
See, I knew that I was going to screw that one up. So, when I pause, will you fill in the right pronunciations for some of these
words? I'm glad he doesn't dump you all.
All right. Here we go. What you pawn, I will redeem. New. One day you have a home and the next you don't, but I'm not going to tell you my particular reasons for being homeless, because it's my secret story, and Indians have to work hard to keep secrets from hungry white folks. I'm a Spokane Indian boy, an Interior Salish, and my people have lived within a 100-mile radius of Spokane, Washington for at least 10,000 years. I grew up in Spokane, moved to Seattle 23 years ago for college, flunked out within 2 semesters, worked various blue and bluer collar jobs for many years, married 2 or 3 times, fathered 2 or 3 kids, and then went crazy. Of course, crazy is not the official definition of my mental problem, but I don't think asocial disorder fits it either, because that makes me sound like I'm a serial killer or something. I've never hurt another human being, or at least not physically. I've broken a few hearts in my time, but we've all done that, so I'm nothing special in that regard. I'm a boring heartbreaker at that, because I've never abandoned one woman for another. I never dated or married more than one woman at a time. I didn't break hearts into pieces overnight. I broke them slowly and carefully. I didn't set any land speed records running out the door. Piece by piece, I disappeared, and I've been disappearing ever since. But I'm not going to tell you any more about my brain or my soul. I've been homeless for 6 years. If there's such a thing as being an effective homeless man, I suppose I'm effective. Being homeless is probably the only thing I've ever been good at. I know where to get the best free food. I've made friends with restaurant and convenience store managers who let me use their bathrooms. I don't mean the public bathrooms either. I mean the employees' bathrooms, the clean ones, hidden in the back of the kitchen or the pantry or the cooler. I know it sounds strange to be proud of, but it means a lot to me being trustworthy enough to piss in somebody else's clean bathroom. Maybe you don't understand the value of a clean bathroom, but I do. Probably none of this interests you. I probably don't interest you much. Homeless Indians are everywhere in Seattle. We're common and boring, and you walk right on by us, with maybe a look of anger or disgust or even sadness at the terrible fate of the noble savage. But we have dreams and families. I'm friends with a homeless Plains Indian man whose son is the editor of a big-time newspaper back east. That's his story, but we Indians are great storytellers and liars and myth-makers. So maybe that Plains Indian hobo is a plain old everyday Indian. I'm kind of suspicious of him because he describes himself only as Plains Indian, a generic term, and not by a specific tribe. When I asked him why he wouldn't tell me exactly what he is, he said, "Do any of us know exactly what we are?" "Yeah, great, a philosophizing Indian." "Hey," I said, "you got to have a home to be that homely." He laughed and flicked me the eagle and walked away. "But you probably want to know more about the story I'm really trying to tell you." I wander the streets with a regular crew, my teammates, my defenders, and my posse. It's Rosa, Sharon, Junior, and me. We matter to one another if we don't matter to anyone else. Rosa Sharon is a big woman, about 7 feet tall if you're measuring overall effect, and about 5 feet tall if you're talking about the physical. She's a Yakima Indian of the Wishram variety. Junior is a Colville, but there are about 199 tribes that make up the Colville, so he could be anything. Hans, way to go, buddy. He's good looking, though, like he just stepped out of some Don't Litter the Earth public service advertisement. He's got those great big cheekbones that are like planets, you know, with little moons orbiting around them. He gets me jealous, jealous, jealous. If you put Junior and me next to each other, he's the before Columbus arrived Indian, and I'm the after Columbus arrived Indian. I am living proof of the horrible damage that colonialism has done to us skins. But I'm not going to let you know how scared I sometimes get of history and its ways. I'm a strong man, and I know that silence is the best way of dealing with white folks. This whole story started at lunchtime when Rosa Sharon Jr. and I were panning the ham about at Pike Place Market. After about 2 hours of negotiating, we earned $5, good enough for a bottle of fortified courage from the most beautiful 7-Eleven in the world. So we headed over that way, feeling like warrior drunks, and we walked past this pawn shop I'd never noticed before. And that was strange, because we Indians have built-in pawn shop radar. But the strangest thing was the old powwow dance regalia I saw hanging in the window. "That's my grandmother's regalia," I said to Rosa Sharon and Junior. "How do you know for sure?" Junior asked. I didn't know for sure, because I hadn't seen that regalia in person ever. I'd seen only photographs of my grandmother dancing in it, and that was before somebody stole it from her 50 years ago. But it sure looked like my memory of it, and it had all the same colors of feathers and beads that my family always sewed into their powwow regalia. "There's only one way to know for sure," I said. So Rosa Sharon Jr. and I walked into the pawn shop and greeted the old white man working behind the counter. "How can I help you?" he asked. "That's my grandmother's powwow regalia in your window," I said. "Somebody stole it from her 50 years ago, and my family has been looking for it ever since." The pawnbroker looked at me like I was a liar. I understood. Pawn shops are filled with liars. "I'm not lying," I said. "Ask my friends here. They'll tell you." "He's the most honest Indian I know," Rosa said. "All right, honest Indian," the pawnbroker said. "I'll give you the benefit of the doubt. Can you prove it's your grandmother's regalia?" Because they don't want it to be perfect, and because only God is perfect, Indian people sew flaps into their powwow regalia. Flaws into their powwow regalia. My family always sewed one yellow bead somewhere on their regalia, but we always hid it where you had to search hard to find it. "If it really is my grandmother's," I said, "there will be one yellow bead hidden somewhere on it." "All right, then," the pawnbroker said, "let's take a look." He pulled the regalia out of the window, laid it down on his glass counter, and we searched for that yellow bead and found it hidden beneath the armpit. "There it is," the pawnbroker said. He didn't sound surprised. "You were right. This is your grandmother's regalia." "It's been missing for 50 years, Junior said. "Hey, Junior," I said, "it's my family's story. Let me tell it." "All right," he said. "I apologize. You go ahead." "It's been missing for 50 years, I said. "That's his family's sad story," Rosa Sharon said. "Are you going to give it back to him?" "That would be the right thing to do," the pawnbroker said. "But I can't afford to do the right thing. I paid $1,000 for this. I can't give away $1,000. "We could go to the cops and tell them it was stolen," Rosa Sharon said. "Hey," I said to her, "don't go threatening people." The pawnbroker sighed. He was thinking hard about the possibilities. "Well, I suppose you could go to the cops," he said, "but I don't think they'd believe a word you said." He sounded sad about that, like he was sorry for taking advantage of our disadvantages. "What's your name?" the pawnbroker asked. "Jackson," I said. "Is that first or last?" he asked. "Both." "Are you serious?" "Yes, it's true. My mother and father named me Jackson Jackson. My family nickname is Jackson Squared. My family is funny." "All right, Jackson Jackson," the pawnbroker said. "You wouldn't happen to have $1,000, would you?" "We got $5 total," I said. "That's too bad," he said, and thought hard about the possibilities. "I'd sell it to you for $1,000 if you had it. Heck, to make it fair, I'd sell it to you for $999. I'd lose a dollar. It would be the moral thing to do in this case. To lose a dollar would be the right thing." "We've got $5 total," I said again. "That's too bad," he said again, and thought harder about the possibilities. "How about this? I'll give you 24 hours to come up with $999. You come back here at lunchtime tomorrow with the money, and I'll sell it back to you. How does that sound?" "It sounds good," I said. "All right, then," he said, "we have a deal, and I'll get you started. Here's $20 to get you started." He opened up his wallet and pulled out a crisp $20 bill and gave it to me. Rosa Sharon Jr. and I walked out into the daylight to search for $974 more. I shouldn't do this. I'm dying to interrupt the story. Why does he give $20 to Jackson?
Jackson.
So he'll go get drunk and forget about it. Right? 1 p.m.
Jackson's on the
$20 bill. Oh, Jackson's on the $20 bill? You know, this guy got an education. He took some good English classes. 1 p.m. Rosa Sharon Jr. and I carried our $20 bill and our $5 in loose change over to the 7-Eleven. and spent it to buy 3 bottles of imagination. We needed to figure out how to raise all that money in one day. Thinking hard, we huddled in an alley beneath the Alaska Way viaduct and finished off those bottles, 1, 2, and 3. 2 p.m. Rosa Sharon was gone when I woke. I heard later she had hitchhiked back to
Papanish
and was living with her sister on the reservation. Junior was passed out beside me, covered in his own vomit, or maybe somebody else's vomit, and my head hurt from thinking, so I left him alone and walked down to the water. I loved the smell of ocean water. Salt always smells like memory. When I got to the wharf, I ran into 3 Aleut cousins who sat on a wooden bench and stared out at the bay and cried. Most of the homeless Indians in Seattle come from Alaska. One by one, each of them hopped a big working boat in Anchorage or Barrow or Juneau, fished his way south to Seattle, jumped off the boat with a pocket full of cash to party hard at one of the highly sacred and traditional Indian bars, went broke and broker, and has been trying to find his way back to the boat in the frozen north ever since. These Aleuts smell like salmon, I thought, and they told me they were going to sit on that wooden bench until their boat came back. How long has your boat been gone? I asked. 11 years, the elder Aleut said. I cried with them for a while. Hey, I said, do you guys have any money I can borrow? They didn't. 3 p.m. I walked back to Junior. He was still passed out. I put my face down near his mouth to make sure he was breathing. He was alive, so I dug around in his blue jean pockets and found half a cigarette. I smoked it all the way down and thought about my grandmother. Her name was Agnes, and she died of breast cancer when I was 14. My father thought Agnes caught her tumors from the uranium mine on the reservation, but my mother said the disease started when Agnes was walking back from the powwow one night and got run over by a motorcycle. She broke 3 ribs, and my mother said those ribs never healed right, and tumors always take over when you don't heal right. Sitting beside Junior, smelling the smoke and salt and vomit, I wondered if my grandmother's cancer had started when somebody stole her powwow regalia. Maybe the cancer started in her broken heart and then leaked into her breasts. I know it's crazy, but I wondered if I could bring my grandmother back to life if I bought back her regalia. I needed money, big money, so I left Junior and walked over to the Real Change office.
That's a real place, by the way.
Which is a real place.
Real Change.
Real paper.
Yeah, yeah, it's the newspaper in Seattle that's kind of about poverty issues, and homeless folks can make money by selling it.
Which you're about to find out. Yeah, 4 p.m. Real Change is a multifaceted organization that publishes a newspaper, supports cultural projects that empower the poor and homeless, and mobilizes the public around poverty issues.
Okay.
Real Change's mission is to organize, educate, and build alliances to create solutions to homelessness and poverty. They exist to provide a voice to poor people in our community.
And Sherman actually published a series of 6 poems, I think maybe even exclusive to Real Change.
Is that right?
Kind of a way to help them out.
I memorized Real Change's mission statement because I sometimes sell the newspaper on the streets. But you have to stay sober to sell it, and I'm not always good at staying sober. Anybody can sell the newspaper. You buy each copy for 30 cents and sell it for $1 and keep the net profit. I need 1,430 papers, I said to the big boss. That's a strange number, he said, and that's a lot of papers. I need them. The big boss pulled out the calculator and did the math. It will cost you $429 for that money, he said. If I had that kind of money, I wouldn't need to sell the papers. What's going on, Jackson to the second power, he asked. He is the only man who calls me that. He is a funny and kind man. I told him about my grandmother's powwow regalia and how much money I needed to buy it back. We should call the police, he said. I don't want to do that, I said. It's a quest now. I need to win it back by myself. I understand, he said. And to be honest, I'd give you the papers to sell if I thought it would work. But the record for most papers sold in a day by one vendor is only 302. That would net me about $200, I said. The big boss used his calculator. $211.40, he said. That's not enough, I said. The most money anybody has made in one day is $525, and that's because somebody gave Old Blue $500 bills for some dang reason. The average daily net is about $30. This isn't going to work. No. Can you lend me some money? I can't do that, he said. If I lend you money, I have to lend money to everybody. What can you do? I'll give you 50 papers for free, but don't tell anybody I did it. Okay, I said. He gathered up the newspapers and handed them to me. I held them to my chest. He hugged me. I carried the newspapers back toward the water. 5 p.m. Back on the wharf, I stood near the Bainbridge Island terminal and tried to sell papers to business commuters walking onto the ferry. I sold 5 in 1 hour, dumped the other 45 into a garbage can, and walked into the McDonald's, ordered 4 cheeseburgers for $1 each, and slowly ate them. After eating, I walked outside and vomited on the sidewalk. I hated to lose my food so soon after eating it. As an alcoholic Indian with a busted stomach, I always hope I can keep enough food in my stomach to stay alive. 6 p.m. With $1 in my pocket, I walked back to Junior. He was still passed out, so I put my ear to his chest and listened for his heartbeat. He was alive, so I took off his shoes and socks and found $1 in his left sock and 50 cents in his right sock. With $2.50 in my hand, I sat beside Junior and thought about my grandmother and her stories. When I was 16, my grandmother told me a story about World War II. She was a nurse in a military hospital in Sydney, Australia. Over the course of 2 years, she comforted and healed U.S. and Australian soldiers. One day, she tended to a wounded Maori soldier. He was very dark-skinned. His hair was black and curly, and his eyes were black and warm. His face was covered with bright tattoos. "Are you Maori?" he asked my grandmother. "No," she said. "I'm Spokane Indian from the United States." "Ah, yes," he said. "I have heard of your tribes. But you are the first American Indian I have ever met." "There's a lot of Indian soldiers fighting for the United States," she said. "I have a brother still fighting in Germany, and I lost another brother on Okinawa." "I am sorry," he said. "I was on Okinawa as well. It was terrible." He had lost his legs to an artillery attack. "I'm sorry about your legs," my grandmother said. "It's funny, isn't it?" he asked. "What's funny?" "How we brown people are killing other brown people so white people will remain free." "I hadn't thought of it that way." "Well, sometimes I think of it that way, and other times I think of it the way they want me to think of it. I get confused." She fed him morphine. "Do you believe in heaven?" he asked. "Which heaven?" she asked. "I'm talking about the heaven where my legs are waiting for me," they laughed. "Of course," he said, "my legs will probably run away from me when I get to heaven. And how will I ever catch them?" "You have to get your arms strong," my grandmother said, "so you can run on your hands." They laughed again. Sitting beside Junior, I laughed with the memory of my grandmother's story. I put my hand close to Junior's mouth to make sure he was still breathing. Yes, Junior was alive. So I took his $2.50 and walked to the Korean grocery store over in Pioneer Square. 7 p.m. In the Korean grocery store, I bought a 50-cent cigar and 2 scratch lottery tickets for $1 each. The maximum cash prize was $500 a ticket. If I won both, I would have enough money to buy back the regalia. I loved Kay, the young Korean woman who worked the register. She was the daughter of the owners and sang all day. "I love you," I said when I handed her the money. "You always say you love me," she said. "That's because I will always love you. You're a sentimental fool." "I'm a romantic old man. Too old for me. I know I'm too old for you, but I can dream." "Okay," she said. "I agree to be part of your dreams, but I will only hold your hand in your dreams. No kissing and no sex. Not even in your dreams." "Okay," I said. "No sex, just romance. Goodbye, Jackson Jackson, my love. I will see you soon." I left the store, walked over to Occidental Park, sat on a bench and smoked my cigar all the way down. 10 minutes after I finished the cigar, I scratched my first lottery ticket and won nothing. So I could win only $500 now, and that would be just half of what I needed. 10 minutes later, I scratched my other lottery ticket and won a free ticket, a small consolation, and one more chance to win money. I walked back to Kay. "Jackson Jackson," she said, "have you come back to claim my heart?" "I want a free ticket," I said. "Just like a man," she said. "You love money and power more than you love me." "It's true," I said, "and I'm sorry it's true." She gave me another scratch ticket, and I carried it outside. I like to scratch my tickets in private. Hopeful and sad, I scratched that third ticket and won real money. I carried it back inside to Kay. "I want $100," I said. She examined the ticket and laughed. "That's a fortune," she said, and counted out 5 twenties. Our fingertips touched as she handed me the money. I felt electric and constant. "Thank you," I said, and gave her one of the bills. "I can't take that," she said. "It's your money." "No, it's tribal. It's an Indian thing. When you win, you're supposed to share with your family." "I'm not your family." "Yes, you are." She smiled. She kept the money. With $80 in my pocket, I said goodbye to my dear Kay and walked out into the cold night air. 8 p.m. I wanted to share the good news with Junior. I walked back to him, but he was gone. I later heard he had hitchhiked down to Portland, Oregon, and died of exposure in an alley behind the Hilton Hotel. Hilton hotels represent wealth to us, right? Wealth and luxury. He dies right next door to wealth. 9 p.m. Lonely for Indians, I carried my $80 over to Big Hearts in South Downtown. Big Hearts is an all-Indian bar. Nobody knows how or why Indians migrate to one bar and turn it into an official Indian bar. But Big Hearts has been an Indian bar for 23 years. It used to be way up on Aurora Avenue, but a crazy Lumi Indian burned that one down, and the owners moved to the new location a few blocks south of Safeco Field. I walked inside Big Hearts and counted 15 Indians, 8 men, and 7 women. I didn't know any of them, but Indians like to belong, so we all pretended to be cousins. "How much for whiskey shots?" I asked the bartender, a fat white guy. "You want the bad stuff or the badder stuff?" "As bad as you got, $1 a shot." I laid my $80 on the bar top. "All right," I said. "Me and all my cousins here are going to be drinking 80 shots. How many is that a piece?" "Counting you?" "Counting you," a woman shouted from behind the bar. "That's 5 shots for everybody." I turned to look at her. She was a chubby and pale Indian sitting with a tall and skinny Indian man. "All right, math genius," I said to her, and then shouted for the whole bar to hear, "5 drinks for everybody." All of the other Indians rushed the bar, but I sat with the mathematician and her skinny friend. We took our time with our whiskey shots. "What's your tribe?" I asked them. "I'm Duwamish," she said. "Is that right?"
Mm-hmm.
"Okay, good." "I'm Duwamish," she said, "and he's Crow." "You're a long way from Montana," I said to him. "I'm Crow," he said. "I flew here." "What's your name?" I asked them. "I'm Irene Muse," she said, "and this is Honey Boy." She shook my hand hard, but he offered his hand like I was supposed to kiss it. So I kissed it. He giggled and blushed, as well as a dark-skinned crow can blush. "You're one of them two-spirits, aren't you?" I asked him. "I love women," he said, "and I love men." "Sometimes both at the same time," Irene said. We laughed. "Man," I said to Honey Boy, "so you must have about 8 or 9 spirits going on inside of you, innit?" "Sweetie," he said, "I'll be whatever you want me to be." "Oh no," Irene said, "Honey Boy is falling in love." "It has nothing to do with love," he said. We laughed. "Wow," I said, "I'm flattered, Honey Boy, but I don't play on your team." "Never say never," he said. "You'd better be careful," Irene said. "Honey Boy knows all sorts of magic. He always makes straight boys fall for him." "Honey Boy," I said, "you can try to seduce me, and Irene, you can try with him. But my heart belongs to a woman named Kay." "Is your Kay a virgin?" Honey Boy asked. We laughed. We drank our whiskey shots until they were gone. But the other Indians bought me more whiskey shots because I'd been so generous with my money. Honey Boy pulled out his credit card, and I drank and sailed on that plastic boat. After a dozen shots, I asked Irene to dance, and she refused. But Honey Boy shuffled over to the jukebox, dropped in a quarter, and selected Willie Nelson's "Help Me Make It Through the Night." As Irene and I sat at the table and laughed and drank some more whiskey, Honey Boy danced a slow circle around us and sang along with Willie. "Are you serenading me?" I asked him. He kept singing and dancing. "Are you serenading me?" I asked him again. "He's going to put a spell on you," Irene said. I leaned over the table, spilling a few drinks, and kissed Irene hard. She kissed me back. 10 p.m. This is the R rating. Irene pushed me into the women's bathroom, into a stall, shut the door behind us, and shoved her hand down my pants. She was short, so I had to lean over to kiss her. I grabbed and squeezed her everywhere I could reach, and she was wonderfully fat, and every part of her body felt like a large, warm, and soft breast. Midnight. Nearly blind with alcohol, I stood alone at the bar and swore I'd been standing in the bathroom with Irene only a minute ago. "One more shot," I yelled at the bartender. "You got no more money," he yelled. "Somebody buy me a drink," I shouted. "They've got no more money. Where's Irene Honeyboy?" Long gone. 2 a.m. Closing time, the bartender shouted at the three or four Indians still drinking hard after a long, hard day of drinking. Indian alcoholics are either sprinters or marathon runners. Where's Irene and Honey Bear, I asked. They've been gone for hours, the bartender said. Where'd they go? I told you 100 times, I don't know. What am I supposed to do? It's closing time. I don't care where you go, but you're not staying here. You're an ungrateful bastard. I've been good to you. You don't leave right now, I'm going to kick your ass. Come on, I know how to fight. He came for me. I don't remember what happened after that. 4 a.m. I emerged from the blackness and discovered myself walking behind a big warehouse. I didn't know where I was. My face hurt. I touched my nose and decided it might be broken. Exhausted and cold, I pulled a plastic tarp from a truck bed and wrapped it around me like a faithful lover and fell asleep in the dirt. 6 a.m. Somebody kicked me in the ribs. I opened my eyes and looked up at a white cop. Jackson, said the cop, is that you? Officer Williams, I said. He was a good cop with a sweet tooth. He'd given me hundreds of candy bars over the years. I wonder if he knew I was a diabetic. What the hell are you doing here, he asked. I was cold and sleepy, I said, so I laid down. You dumbass, you passed out on the railroad tracks. I sat up and looked around. I was lying on the railroad tracks. Dock workers stared at me. I should have been a railroad track pizza, a double Indian pepperoni with extra cheese. Sick and scared, I leaned over and puked whiskey. What the hell's wrong with you, Officer Williams asked. You've never been this stupid. It's my grandmother, I said. She died. Oh, I'm sorry, man. When did she die? 1972. And you're killing yourself now? I've been killing myself ever since you died. He shook his head. He was sad for me. Like I said, he was a good cop. And somebody beat the hell out of you, he said. You remember who? Mr. Grief and I went a few rounds. Looks like Mr. Grief knocked you out. Mr. Grief always wins. Come on, he said, let's get you out of here. He helped me stand and led me over to his squad car. He put me in the back. You throw up in there, he said, you're cleaning it up. That's fair, I said. He walked around the car and sat in the driver's seat. I'm taking you over to detox, he said. No, man, that place is awful, I said. It's full of drunk Indians. We laughed. He drove away from the docks. I don't know, how many guys do it? He said. What guys, I asked. You Indians, how the hell do you laugh so much? I just picked your ass off the railroad tracks and you're making jokes. Why the hell do you do that? The two funniest tribes I've ever been around are Indians and Jews, so I guess that says something about the inherent humor of genocide. We laughed. Listen to you, Jackson, you're so smart. Why the hell are you on the streets? Give me $1,000 and I'll tell you. You bet I'll give you $1,000 if I knew you'd straighten up your life. He meant it. He was the second best cop I'd ever known. You're a good cop, I said. Come on, Jackson, he said. Don't blow smoke up my ass. No, really, you remind me of my grandfather. Yeah, that's what you Indians always tell me. No, man, my grandfather was a tribal cop. He was a good cop. He never arrested people. He took care of them, just like you. I've arrested hundreds of scumbags, Jackson, and I've shot a couple in the ass. It don't matter. You're not a killer. I didn't kill them. I killed their asses. I'm an ass killer. I drove through downtown. The missions and shelters had already released their overnighters. Sleepy homeless men and women stood on corners and stared up at the gray sky. It was the morning after the night of the living dead. Did you ever get scared? I asked Officer Williams. What do you mean? I mean, being a cop, is it scary? He thought about that for a while. He contemplated it. I like that about him. I guess I try not to think about it, about being afraid, he said. If you think about fear, then you'll be afraid. The job is boring most of the time, just driving and looking into dark corners, you know, and seeing nothing. But then things get heavy. You're chasing somebody or fighting them or walking around a dark house, and you just know some crazy guy is hiding around a corner, and hell yes, it's scary. My grandfather was killed in the line of duty, I said. I'm sorry, how did it happen? I knew he'd listen closely to my story. He worked on the reservation. Everybody knew everybody. It was safe. We aren't like those crazy Sioux or Apache or any of those other warrior tribes. There's only been 3 murders on my reservation in the last 100 years. That is safe. Yeah, we Spokane, we're passive, you know. We're mean with words, and we'll cuss out anybody, but we don't shoot people or stab them, not much anyway. So what happened to your grandfather? This man and his girlfriend were fighting down my Little Falls. Domestic dispute, those are the worst. Yeah, But this guy was my grandfather's brother, my great uncle. Oh no. Yeah, it was awful. My grandfather just strolled into the house. He'd been there 1,000 times. And his brother and his girlfriend were all drunk and beating on each other. And my grandfather stepped between them just like he'd done 100 times before. And the girlfriend tripped or something. She fell down and hit her head and started crying. And my grandfather knelt down beside her to make sure she was all right. And for some reason, my great uncle reached down, pulled my grandfather's pistol out of the holster, and shot him in the head. That's terrible. I'm sorry. Yeah, my great uncle could never figure out why he did it. He went to prison forever, you know. And he always wrote these long letters, like 50 pages of tiny little handwriting. He was always trying to figure out why he did it. He'd write and write and write and try to figure it out. He never did. It's a great big mystery. You remember your grandfather? A little bit. I remember the funeral. My grandfather wouldn't let them bury him. Grandmother wouldn't let them bury him. My father had to drag her away from the grave. I don't know what to say. I don't know either. We stopped in front of the detox center. We're here, Officer Williams said. I can't go in there, I said. You have to. Please, no. They'll keep me for 24 hours and then it will be too late. Too late for what? I told him about my grandmother's regalia and the deadline for buying it back. If it was stolen, he said, then you need to file reports. I'll investigate it myself. If that thing is really your grandmother's, I'll get it back for you, legally. No, I said, that's not fair. The pawnbroker didn't know it was stolen. And besides, I'm on a mission here. I want to be a hero, you know? I want to win it back like a knight. That's romantic crap. It might be, but I care about it. It's been a long time since I really cared about something. Officer Williams turned around in his seat and stared at me. He studied me. I'll give you some money, he said. I don't have much, only $30. I'm short until payday, and it's not enough to get back the regalia, but it's something. I'll take it, I said. I'm giving it to you because I believe in what you believe. I'm hoping, and I don't know why I'm hoping it, but I hope you can turn $30 into $1,000 somehow. I believe in magic. I believe you'll take my money and get drunk on it. Then why are you giving it to me? There ain't no such thing as an atheist cop. Sure there is. Yeah, well, I'm not an atheist cop. He let me out of the car, handed me 2 fives and a 20, and shook my hand. Take care of yourself, Jackson, he said. Stay off the railroad tracks. I'll try, I said. He drove away. Carrying my money, I headed back toward the car. I think this is a really important section coming up. 8 a.m. On the wharf, those three Aleut men stood waiting on the wooden bench. Have you seen your ship? I asked. Seen a lot of ships, the elder Aleut said, but not our ship. I sat on the bench with them. We sat in silence for a long time. I wondered whether we would fossilize if we sat there long enough. I thought about my grandmother. I'd never seen her dance in her regalia. More than anything, I wished I'd seen her dance at a powwow. Do you guys know any songs? I asked the Aleuts. I know all of Hank Williams, the elder Aleut said. How about Indian songs? Hank Williams is Indian. How about sacred songs? Hank Williams is sacred. I'm talking about ceremonial songs, you know, religious ones, the songs you sing back home when you're wishing and hoping. What are you wishing and hoping for? I'm wishing my grandmother was still alive. Every song I know is about that. Well, sing me as many as you can. The Aleuts sang their strange and beautiful songs. I listened. They sang about my grandmother and their grandmothers. They were lonely for the cold and snow. I was lonely for everybody. 10 a.m. After the Aleuts finished their last song, we sat in silence. Indians are good at silence. Was that the last song, I asked? We sang all the ones we could, the elder Aleut said. All the others are just for our people. I understood. We Indians have to keep our secrets. And these Aleuts were so secretive that they didn't refer to themselves as Indians. Are you guys hungry, I asked. They looked at one another and communicated without talking. We could eat, the elder Aleut said. 11 a.m. The Aleuts and I walked over to Mother's Kitchen, a greasy diner in the International District. I knew they served homeless Indians who'd locked into money. 4 for breakfast, the waitress asked when we stepped inside. Yes, we're very hungry, the elder Aleut said. She sat us in a booth near the kitchen. I could smell the food cooking. My stomach growled. You guys want separate checks, the waitress asked. No, I'm paying for it, I said. Aren't you the generous one, she said. Don't do that, I said. Do what, she asked. Don't ask me rhetorical questions. They scare me. She looked puzzled and then she laughed. "Okay, Professor," she said. "I'll only ask you real questions from now on. Thank you. What do you guys want to eat?" "That's the best question anybody can ask anybody," I said. "How much money you got?" she asked. "Another good question," I said. "I've got $25 I can spend. Bring us all the breakfast you can, plus your tip." She knew the math. "All right, that's 4 specials and 4 coffees and 15% for me." The Aleuts and I waited in silence. Soon enough, the waitress returned and poured us 4 coffees, and we sipped at them until she returned again with 4 plates of food. Eggs, bacon, toast, hash brown potatoes. It is amazing how much food you can buy for so little money. Grateful, we feasted. Noon. I said farewell to the Aleuts and walked toward the pawn shop. I later heard the Aleuts had waded into the salt water near Dock 47 and disappeared. Some Indians said the Aleuts walked on the water and headed north. Other Indians saw the Aleuts drown. I don't know what happened to them. I looked for the pawn shop and couldn't find it. I swear it wasn't located in the place where it had been before. I walked 20 or 30 blocks looking for the pawn shop, turned corners and bisected intersections, looked up its name in the phone books, and asked people walking past me if they'd ever heard of it. But that pawn shop seemed to have sailed away from me like a ghost ship. I wanted to cry. Right when I'd given up, when I turned one last corner and thought I might die if I didn't find that pawn shop, there it was, located in a space I swore it hadn't been filling up a few minutes before. I walked inside and greeted the pawnbroker, who looked a little younger than he had before. "It's you," he said. "Yes, it's me," I said. "Jackson Jackson, that is my name." "Where are your friends?" "They went traveling, but it's okay, Indians are everywhere." "Do you have my money?" "How much do you need again?" I asked and hoped the price had changed. $999. It was still the same price. Of course it was the same price. Why would it change? "I don't have that," I said. "What do you have?" $5. I set the crumpled Lincoln on the countertop. The pawnbroker studied it. "Is that the same $5 from yesterday?" "Nope, it's different." He thought about the possibilities. "Did you work hard for this money?" he asked. "Yes," I said. He closed his eyes and thought harder about the possibilities. Then he stepped into his back room and returned with my grandmother's regalia. "Take it," he said and held it out to me. "I don't have the money." "I don't want your money." "But I wanted to win it." "You did win it. Now take it before I change my mind." "Do you know how many good men live in this world?" "Too many to count." I took my grandmother's regalia and walked outside. I knew that solitary yellow bead was part of me. I knew I was that yellow bead in part. Outside, I wrapped myself in my grandmother's regalia and breathed her in. I stepped off the sidewalk and into the intersection. Pedestrians stopped. Cars stopped. The city stopped. They all watched me dance with my grandmother. I was my grandmother, dancing. Isn't that a great story?
That
was amazing. Yeah. Well, let me hear your questions, your reactions, anything you want to say about the story, and then we'll get analytical about it in a few minutes. We have 17 minutes.
Did you have more copies?
I'm afraid I don't. I have one copy in my room, which I can... How many... Would people like me to make additional copies and provide them to you?
Somebody wants this one, I'm welcome to.
Well, that's... We could do the loaves and fishes with them, too.
Thank you, Lynn.
complications to deal with this man.
The other, the images of the Indian companions he had, how they all disappeared, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them rather ambivalently, where you didn't know where they ended up. It was,
they kind of melted away from him.
Yeah, he didn't seem to be able to sustain a relationship with anybody all the way through, except his grandmother.
Yeah, his grandmother. And of course, that's a memory relationship, not an actual one. Yeah. Well, the most... for my money, the most lovely relationship is the relationship he has with the Korean girl Kay in the grocery.
I have a question on that. In the one we read, she was married, and in the New Yorker copy. And and then he says, "Is she a virgin?" in that question, and I kind of went.
It's not in the New Yorker version of the story.
The New Yorker, she's married, not Kay. Her name is Mary.
Oh, she's Mary.
Yeah.
Well, that makes sense, doesn't it?
Yeah, and then he says, "Is she a virgin?" was the question.
Yeah.
And they married. I thought it was deliberate, so I thought it was interesting that it wasn't Mary in there.
So he softens it before he publishes it in the book.
There were other things.
That was the striking one. Oh, okay. Well, this will teach me to read from two different texts. One.
It was interesting, though.
It is interesting.
It was the changes he made.
See, Mary is maybe, he may have felt it was a little too heavy-handed, that he was pointing a little too clearly at what he wanted that girl to represent, and he had to soften it by just using the gay man saying, "Well, is she a virgin?"
Yeah.
Which is a crass thing on his part to say. In other words, he's sort of measuring her worth by what kind of sexual conquest she'll be for Jackson. But in fact, she's meant to represent, in a sense, Mary, the chaste, motherly figure. We'll take that further before we're done, I think. Yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
I don't know where this fits in the composition, but I couldn't help but notice at the beginning he estimates that he was married two or three times. But then after that, everything is exact amounts.
Yeah.
Exact amounts of money, exact amounts of shots, exact amounts of everything.
Right. And two characters throughout the story that he calls mathematicians. And actually, value and monetary value and numbering things seems to be important as a theme throughout the story.
Mm-hmm.
Very curious. Yes, go ahead.
Do you think that has to do with the being private? That at the beginning he's sort of not really starting out telling you exactly who he is?
Well, he does tell us that he keeps secrets, doesn't he?
Yeah, and then later as he gets into the storytelling.
And he's in the business of disappearing.
Yeah.
And Eddie's trying to make his grandmother reappear, which finally works.
Well, I don't know if Fred, I don't know if this is the right time to do this, but it seems to me that the title of this story points to the theme of value. And what do when we pawn? Well, we take something of great value and we trade it in for a lesser amount, right? And usually out of desperation or laziness or there are typically bad reasons to pawn something, or desperate reasons sometimes we're supposed to pawn something. So in other words, we take something of great value, exchange it for something of lesser value, and then relinquish control over it. We exile it from our lives. That's precisely what's happened to this regalia, except for the fact that, of course, it's been stolen and pawned rather than pawned by the original owner. But this thing that's of great value because it represents the integrity of the people, their traditions of celebration, their spiritual traditions, pawned for a few bucks. And that's why the story is about, in a much larger sense, Jackson redeeming that pawn. Go ahead.
I don't know that he redeemed it. It was almost redeemed for him. And I wondered, I don't know if this is the right word either, but he kind of lives, I don't know if it's a word, by grace. He just...
The conclusion of the story is about grace.
I think so.
It is.
He gets... The grace for him in that book is way more than a real homeless person in Seattle. I think Indian or not Indian. I have never heard of a cop treating a homeless person that way.
Right.
There were several people who treated him with a lot of respect.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what his point was in
Well, you know, there is a kind of magic realism going on in the story, the Aleuts and how they disappear. They might have walked on water to leave, but...
Aleut,
okay, thanks. The whole thing has a kind of dream spirit to it, so it may not be meant to be taken as a realistic story. Mm-hmm. It might be a kind of fantasy of how things might be or something like that. Go ahead.
One of the things that's sort of interesting, and I don't know what this is, the fact that the people that really are kind to him, in a way, are not the other native people. There's a kinship
right.
with those other people, but it's the Korean,
right.
you know,
right.
which maybe goes to that.
Yeah.
I mean, because that isn't very realistic, probably.
Well, it is interesting that if there's a redemptive Mary character in the story, that it would turn out to be a Korean girl.
Oh.
Yeah, isn't it? I mean,
and you think of the pawnbroker, the
right.
cop.
Right.
You know, they're
the bartender.
The bartender.
They're
all non-native people. Yeah.
Right.
You're not homeless either.
No.
They're not homeless.
You're not homeless.
But
it's like a...
And so you wonder about that.
But they are all redeeming something, aren't they? I mean, they're redeeming a tradition of cheating pawnbrokers and violent cops and, you know, isn't this true?
Mm-hmm.
Ma'am, you missed
at the beginning of the story where he said the pawn shop appeared where it had never been before, and you know, he'd been living there, how many, 12, 13 years,
mm-hmm.
and then he's looking for it later. I had this feeling like, you know, we're stepping into the boardroom.
Yeah, right, exactly. Right. Either that or he's having GTs, or, you know. It's hard to know why he has difficulty locating this place, but I prefer the magic realism a formula that says, you know, there's a kind of magic at work in this story.
What are DTs?
Oh, delirium tremens, hallucinations caused by alcoholism.
Okay.
Didn't learn that.
Okay.
Someone just learned another guy.
You know, one of the things we could do to take the watch apart on this story and see how it ticks is to look for the sort of prepared parallelisms and that sort of thing. I'll give you one, and then you see if you can come up with some others. There are two meals taken in the story. And the first one occurs at McDonald's, which, as we all know, is the symbol of corporate America. Maybe Walmart is overtaking McDonald's now, but the symbol of corporate America.
Interesting that he threw it all.
And he throws that one up. He can't keep it on his stomach, right? But later in the story, he goes to Mother's Diner in the international district. And there is treated with first some condescension, and then he corrects the condescension.
Mm-hmm.
He says, no more rhetorical questions, right, to the waitress. And then is served a meal which he keeps on his stomach and which he shares with others and which provides real nutrition, you know. Really quite a nice contrast, I think, between the two. And it seems to say something about how, I think there's an economic parable going on here, that somehow the local place in the international district is good for us, and McDonald's is a problem.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
I also wonder if the stolen regalia kind of symbolizes all that was stolen from the Indians in terms of dignity.
I think that's right, exactly. Interesting that Kay Mary teases Jackson by saying, oh, you're just like all other men. You claim you want love, but you want power and money.
Money, yeah.
Money and power. And the story ends with real power. He gets the regalia back, and when he wears the regalia and steps out into the street, he's able to stop traffic. He's able to stop, what are the other ones? He stops the whole city.
Whole city.
Yeah.
I thought
cars.
He was hit by the cars.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was waiting for that.
Pardon?
I said I thought he was hit by the cars.
No.
I felt like that was maybe where it was going. Well,
yeah. It seemed to be headed that way, wasn't it?
We don't know what happened to the guys that went into the water.
No, we don't know that either.
Or there are the two cops too. The grandfather,
right.
Yeah. And the.
That's interesting, isn't it? Because the grandfather story is a parable of Indian-on-Indian violence. Why did the great uncle kill his brother?
He was drunk.
He was drunk. He was drunk? He couldn't actually answer his name. But then he himself contemplated for the rest of his life why he had done it. So it seems to me it must be more complex psychologically somehow.
Was it because he was bending over this woman, this guy's girlfriend?
Maybe he suddenly thought, what's going on with them?
So shame could be bound up in
somehow. Shame, absolutely, yeah. Because here he gets beat up, and here's his brother helping her up.
Yeah.
Well, here's
the
life story.
And,
because he was fired, his former police chief was drunk and took a gun and shot his best friend.
Mm-hmm.
And he can't tell anybody why he does it. You know, he wishes he did it.
Well, this madness does happen. There's no doubt that madness like this does happen. I have my own theory, which is that you know, everything that's in the literature is unemblematic. My own theory in this case is that the great uncle might have killed his brother because he was killing that part of himself that was still cared, that still could show compassion. Mm-hmm. It's in a sense the measure of his lostness that he kills his brother. So that's my own sort of take on it. We've got about 2 minutes left for further great observations on this story.
Why do you think you want to bring the same religious ceremonial thing?
Well,
spirituality?
Yeah, that's, yeah. I don't speak about anything for that to stop. I think it's rude to do this, but I have to return a question with a question. I want to ask the whole group, in fact, does this story hold up something like Indian traditions, ethics, and ceremonies as, you know, fundamentally redeeming or redemptive? That would be one thing. That would be one reason why he wants the Aleuts.
Aleuts.
Okay. To sing the ceremonial song. If you think that's what's going on in the story.
I thought that was some very deep caring. At a level that was probably something beyond the human experience. They were trying to play. The reader doesn't necessarily understand, but it's like, could be like generational grief, or they only meant so far before they see the
story. I do think there's a subtext of native traditions going on here. For example, he buys a 50-cent cigar and smokes it down before he scratches the two lottery tickets. You know about tobacco in the native community, and it's a form of blessing, a form of sharing. You might do that for good luck before you scratch the lottery tickets, you know? And it does, and that kind of works for him. But why turn to the Christian symbol of Mary? Why turn to the medieval symbol, or the medieval tradition of romance and knightly quest? To frame the story. There's a lot of Western framing of the action as well as Native framing.
It's a sense of identity. The very Lord David is brought back to our forest, and yet he belongs to the bigger tradition of family to represent something that gives him identity and brings the answers from. People take note of him, that it's more than his life.
Yeah, let's close with that. And in Jackson, that sense of identity is not just a kind of psychological sureness. It's bound up with generosity and loving kindness and integrity and spiritual depth, I would say. And that, to me, is the loveliest part of this story. That
also, the justice for the dominant religion of the Upper Columbia Indians.
Yeah.
Including the
Scottish. Yeah. Alexei was educated in Catholic schools, apparently. I'll close with this. He said in an interview that I read today that he thinks that America will be redeemed from its colonial past. And the thing that's going to redeem us, and this might bring us back to the Korean girl, the thing that's going to redeem us is the fact that completely outside of our control, just because of ordinary sexual urges, this country is going to get browner and browner and browner over the next 100 years. And pretty soon, whiteness might not be such a big problem. Maybe the Korean girl in the International District is helping to form a new America that's going to be all the more just and caring. Let's hope so. Tomorrow, G.K. Chesterton, who wrote a book about Christian orthodoxy and then wrote these goofy kind of Arthur Conan Doyle stories about a guy named Father Brown, Father Brown Mysteries. I won't claim they're deep stories, they're kind of interesting. G.K. Chesterton, as you probably know, was fundamental in restoring or supplying a kind of Christian faith for C.S. Lewis and John Updike, among others. So, might be interesting. Anyway, I have copies of the story. It's called The Blue Cross. Otherwise, you can come and listen to the story. Or go to another good session.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You got it.